My castaway this week is a writer. His success is proof, if proof were needed, that we the British like nothing better than being liked. A small-time journalist from a small-time town, Des Moines, Iowa, an American beacon of insignificance, he was happily pottering along as a newspaper man in this country when 10 years ago he gave up his job and produced his first book, The Lost Continent. Another travel book followed, neither here nor there, and then in 1995, the one that made him a favourite in Britain, Notes from a Small Island. He's now returned to America, but his latest book, Notes from a Big Country, is a very large postcard proving he hasn't forgotten us, nor we him. It's another bestseller. I am, he says, just a tourist who writes books. He is Bill Bryson. I find that a rather disingenuous statement, actually, Bill, because there's much more emotional commitment in your books than just a kind of passing tourist.
I don't know. I mean, they're not intended to be anything other than light entertainments.
But you've been pigeonholed as a travel writer. Perhaps that's not what you are. You're a humorous writer, are you, who happens to get his material from people and places?
Well, the point of you know, disowning myself as a travel writer is simply that, I mean, there are a lot of very, very wonderful, real travel writers out there, and I don't pretend to be that kind of a writer. What I you know, I don't go off and ride camels across deserts and go through a great deal of
But you walk
hardship.
Through woods and up and down mountains.
I have done that. That was the one, you know, genuine travel writer type experience I've had. But mostly I'm a guy that, you know, I don't do deserts, I do motels. And
it's often stuff from your childhood, it's little anecdotes as well.
Exactly,
and then
yeah.
There'll be a bit of botany in it or a bit of history in it or a bit of linguistics. I mean, it's very accommodating as a genre. Perhaps you've created this genre.
Well, no, I certainly haven't created it, but it you're absolutely right. It is incredibly accommodating. It's the thing that I like about it so much is that with travel writing, you can do virtually anything you could do with, say, fiction in terms of, unlike, say, biography or history or something like that, where you're stuck with you know, you have to be chronological and you have to deal with things as they unfold. With travel writing, you can go all over the place. I mean, you can talk about what's happening to you at that moment, or you can use that as an occasion to hark back to some earlier, totally unrelated experience.
And you don't have to tell the truth. You can exaggerate to make the point.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, I think it has to be grounded in truth.
Well, I'm thinking of Mrs. Smegma, your first British landlady.
Well, is indeed grounded in truth. Clearly, her name was not Mrs. Smegma. She was is something of a composite of lots of different landladies I ran into in that first trip to Britain, hitchhiking around the country. But almost all those things happened exactly as I described them in the book. Telling me to switch off the lights.
Telling you when you could and couldn't be in your room.
That's
that you
right.
were paying for.
That's exactly. You know, that you're expected not to return to the room until 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
She was pretty off-putting in the beginning when you came to Britain by the sound of her. But so was our weather, which you've described very memorably for me as mostly dull, a land without shadows, like living inside Tupperware. How come you like us?
Well, I was talking there about a British winter. There were a lot of little things. I just admired a lot of the things about the country. But it was something more than that. I mean, I liked it here from the first moment. I really, really did. The only thing I can compare it to is the experience of when you know, fall in love with your wife or partner. You know, with my wife, I think she's lovely and attractive and delightful and a very interesting person and all that. But I love her because she's her, you know. I mean, it goes beyond that. And I felt rather that way about Britain. There was just something about it that suited me. And I've never stopped feeling that way.
But you've gone away. I'm going to ask you about that. Tell me about your first record.
The first record is a little piece of Gershwin Concerto in F for piano. I love Gershwin. He seems to me, you know, the great quintessential musical maestro of the 20th century in America. Thank you.
Garrick Olson with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra playing part of Gershwin's Concerto in F for piano and orchestra, conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas. I have this image of you, Bill Bryson, for those 10 years that you worked as a newspaper man in this country, be it on the Bournemouth Evening Echo, the Times, or the Independent, secretly plotting your escape as you plodded in and out to work.
Well, what happened was that I was working as a sub-editor on newspapers, enjoyed it very much, could be doing it yet if things hadn't changed. I mean, I'd have been quite happy doing that forever. But what happened was that I started freelancing, doing articles for magazines and newspapers, and gradually discovered that I enjoyed that more.
But apparently, descriptions of you at the time have you as a pretty regular kind of guy who was quite quiet, kept himself to, you know, decent and solid, turned up at the right time. But nobody had you down as a great wit.
No, well, and I'm not. I mean, I really am not at all. I'm the world's worst teller of stories.
But not in writing.
No, I can only, you know, I can only do that through my fingertips. I'm one of these people that when I try to tell a story, I keep interrupting myself and say, no, it was a Wednesday and it was Lancashire, it wasn't Yorkshire. And, you know, one of those hopeless storytellers. What surprised me was the discovery that how many people assumed, writer journalists assumed, that it was impossible for a sub-editor to write as well, as if this were a skill that was beyond them, which I thought was a little bit condescending.
Yes, wasn't there a famous comment from the deputy editor when you left the Independent, which was, I didn't know he could write.
Yes. It's not actually a skill that is unique to practicing journalists. I mean, a lot of people could write.
But what gave you the guts to do it?
What happened was we went up to the Dales on holiday one year. We had a cottage for a couple of weeks. I fell in love with the landscape. I obviously had been doing a lot of complaining about driving in and out of London and being tired of stuck at a desk and saying, I'd sure like to write for a living. Go back to London at the end of the holiday. I go to work. The first day back at work, I get a phone call from my wife. She almost never called me at work. And she says, I just thought you'd like to know I've put the house on the market.
My God.
And I said, you've what? And she said, and what's more, someone's coming tomorrow to look at it. And these people came the next day, bought our house, and that was it. I mean, we were committed.
Tell me about your second record.
The second one I chose was Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding. I think it's just a really, really lovely song. It's so simple. And yet, I don't think there's a person on the planet who doesn't like this song.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. 'Cause I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
Otis Redding, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Almost immediately, Bill, then, you got the commission for The Lost Continent, and that was published in 1989. It's about the States. It's you driving around them in your mother's beaten-up old Chevrolet. And I think I'm right in saying that it's lost in two senses. Lost to you, because you no longer live there, and lost to itself because what was worthwhile was being destroyed, you seem to be saying. What was it that was worthwhile that you were mourning the passing of?
Well, I just think there was this, in the 50s when I was growing up, there was a greater simplicity to life. I mean, America really had it right in the 50s, and I think we've moved beyond that now. It had it right in the sense that it was an era of great prosperity and comfort and an era of real possibility. I mean, there was just a sense of moving forward. opportunity for all, that kind of thing. Things, the sort of things that nations strive for, we seem to have acquired that kind of level
so
of comfort.
So it's inevitable that we've gone past it, but you're saying that that was the beautiful moment.
Yes, and but what troubles me now about America is that we have gone so far past that. You know, I'm struck again and again. Now that we're living back in the States, I go to a shopping mall or something and I look around me and I think, is this really what it's all about? This, all we do in this country is work and make money and spend it. It's true of the world generally, but it's especially true of the States.
But you were, in a way, looking for a myth when you went back there, weren't you? Mm. You were looking for the kind of classic American town where Henry Fonda was the kind of principal of the local high school. You were looking for something that didn't really exist.
No, and this had always troubled me, right from quite early childhood, that the small towns that I saw in movies and on television, I read about in books like The Hardy Boys, and that sort of thing, they all took place in this perfect little happy, well-constructed small town. And then you think about things like Norman Rockwell paintings and all of that. I mean, Americans celebrate small town life in a way that almost no one else does. And yet, you know, when we would go on these mammoth summer vacations with my dad driving this old Rambo station wagon all over the country, we hardly ever saw towns that looked even remotely like these ones from the movies. And it had always bothered me. I thought that they've got to be out there somewhere. And that was part of my quest when I went to do The Lost Continent, was I was traveling around, I was looking for the perfect small town.
But weren't you also recapturing that childhood with your father? Because every summer I think he took you out like that, didn't he? Somewhere across the States.
My father was an absolute demon for going out on big summer vacations. I mean, he would spend a good deal of the winter sitting down with maps and the AAA guidebooks, AAA being the American equivalent of AA or RAC, partly because he liked all the detail and partly because he was always looking to see how much money he could save. He liked to be prepared because he was a great cheapskate. And then he would take us out for 3 weeks every summer and we would go.
And you always got lost?
Always lost. My father had my father had this remarkable ability to get very close to the entrance to whatever we were looking for. I mean, if it was in a big amusement park, it would always be within sight, but he would never actually find the front gate.
Going up and down past.
Yes, and we would pass this thing like an airplane making passes, low passes over an unfamiliar airport. And we would see it, you know, first to be out the right-hand side of the car. And there it is, and then 3 minutes later, it'd be out the left-hand side of the car. And it was always, you know, there'd always be like some great industrial zone standing between us and it.
But he obviously gave you the travel bug. That's where you got it from.
I think so, yeah. But also, I think that just growing up in Iowa, which then and now felt like a very long way away from everywhere,
well,
is what gave it to me.
It is
like a little remote island, except that instead of being surrounded by water, you're surrounded by fields of corn. But for as far as, you know, it takes days to get anywhere from Iowa.
You now famously now wrote as your opening sentence to that first book, "I come from Iowa." Well, somebody had to. Was it really so desperate? You know, as well as being so large.
No, well, desperate only in the sense if you have aspirations or ambitions to see a wider world, it's pretty desperate. In terms of just a comfortable, safe, clean, wholesome place to grow up, it couldn't be bettered. I mean, it was a really wonderful place. Iowans are the nicest people on Earth. They really are.
Third record.
When I was quite a young man, my first car was a little MG Midget. And I bought this car and I was immensely proud of it. And I was out waxing it one warm summer evening in Des Moines and had an 8-track tape deck in it and was listening to this album and this particular song. And it was just one of those moments when life seemed really good.
Paul McCartney, and that would be something. So, Bill Bryson, you came to Britain, as we've heard, in the early 70s, fell in love with all sorts of quirky things about us, our Belisha beacons and our feathered pheasants and skinned rabbits hanging in the butchers. How long did it take you to get into the really quintessential stuff, you know, Marmite and Tony Hancock and allotments?
I've never got into Marmite. I've tried. There's certain things that just end up defeating you.
But you tried.
I tried with Marmite. I tried with cricket. I really, really tried with cricket.
But you can't.
No, I can watch the edited highlights. When they squeeze it all down to 45 minutes, a whole day's play is, you know, compressed, then it starts to become quite a lively game.
It must have been very difficult, though, nevertheless, when you first came here and you went to work on the Bournemouth Evening Echo, that must have been full of parochial English bits and pieces that you couldn't understand, like kind of rotary clubs and biggest leak competitions. And
Townswomen Guild and Women's Institute reports. We used to spend whole afternoons. You'd get a pile, all written in the same gushing prose, and a good time was had by all of Mrs. Smithers, you know, brought the flower arrangement, and it would take you all afternoon to get through them.
Then you went to the Times, and of course that was during the Wapping dispute when Rupert Murdoch took on the print unions, mid-80s. Your description of that in Notes from a Small Island has been said to be definitive, and I have to say one remembers particularly the Luddite called Vince in the telex room that you described. Was he real? Tell me about him.
Yeah, he was absolutely real. Not his real name, but there was this man whose job was to tear off wire copy, you know, pieces of paper that came in on all the various teletype machines and distribute them around. And there's obviously a certain urgency on newspapers that you need. I worked on the business section. We needed the Wall Street closing prices every night. And because of these bizarre and Byzantine lines of demarcation that worked there then, we weren't allowed to cross the threshold of the room in which all this clattering activity was going on. You were totally dependent on this terrifying brute, whom I called Vince in the book, and he would give you those pieces of paper that you needed when it rather pleased him to. The structure of Fleet Street back then was just so bizarre. It had developed over such a long period, and it got so ugly that it really was coming to a kind of explosive point anyway without Rupert Murdoch. I mean, he merely pricked the balloon, as it were, but it would have happened anyway.
But despite all of that, and despite the fact that iniquitous bonuses were being claimed by these unions and that the management, the companies were paying people who didn't exist, weren't they? I mean, there were a lot of people on the payroll who simply didn't exist. Nevertheless, you didn't approve, it seems to me, from what you've written, of Murdoch's actions. Why not?
Well, it was, I mean, personally, it was very painful for us. We were put into this terrible position where we were having to cross picket lines. And we weren't only crossing the picket lines that were manned by the likes of Vince, these people that had terrified us, but also, you know, cast out into the street had been people who'd worked in the canteen, and people, the librarians, the secretaries, all of the people from unions that were not particularly bolshy, and certainly on a day-to-day personal level, these people were our friends. And a lot of people, braver people than I, you know, left and wouldn't do it. You know, I didn't. I regret that I didn't, but I had baby and mortgage and all that, and like most other people, I just sort of did it and left as soon as I could afford to. I mean, as soon as an opportunity presented itself, 8 months later, I did leave.
Record number four.
Oh, it's Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, Tom Lehrer. Really very, very funny guy, an academic, American academic, who wrote very funny songs in the 50s. And what I remember about this is being quite small and listening to my parents, listening to an album of Tom Lehrer songs and laughing very hard while I was up in bed trying to get to sleep and just, you know, regretting that I wasn't big enough to go down and join them.
Spring is here, a suffering is here. Life is Skittles and life is beer. I think the loveliest time of the year is the spring. I do, don't you? Of course you do. But there's one thing that makes spring complete for me and makes every Sunday a treat for me. All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeons in the park. When they see us coming, the birdies all try and hide, but they still go for peanuts when coated with cyanide. The sun's shining bright, everything seems all right when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. We've gained notoriety and caused much anxiety in the Audubon Society with our games. They call it impiety and lack of propriety and quite a variety of unpleasant names. But it's not against any religion to want to dispose of a pigeon. So if Sunday you're free, why don't you come with me and we'll poison the pigeons in the park. And maybe we'll do in a squirrel or two while we're poisoning pigeons in the park. We'll murder them all amid laughter and merriment, except for the few we take home to experiment. My pulse will be quickening with each drop of strychnine we feed to a pigeon. It just takes a smidgen to poison a pigeon in the park.
Tom Lehrer, Poisoning Pigeons in the Park. So you took to the Yorkshire Dales. You had another baby, so he can play cricket for Yorkshire. The writing was proving lucrative. You'd done the States, done bits of Europe in Neither Here Nor There, and you decided to do us, Notes from a Small Island.
Well, what happens is we decided, after we'd been living in Yorkshire for 8 years, we decided to go back to the States for a while, principally to give the kids the experience of living in another country. I'd always felt very lucky that I'd had this chance to be part of two cultures. And so when we had taken this decision that we would move back to America for a time, I thought, well, this would be the opportunity, the occasion to go off and make a sort of valedictory tour of Britain, this place that had been my very happy home for 20 years.
I would have thought a publisher might have been worried about you writing about us, because you'd been pretty rude about, you know, your own people, the Americans. You'd written, hadn't you, about your hometown Iowans. They're the sort of people who spent their days circling letters in books called Word Puzzles for Morons. Did they realise you were going to be very nice about us?
No, they didn't. I was much more worried than the publishers were. They thought that a book on Britain would be, commercially, would be a very attractive proposition, I think. I was much more nervous about the possibility of alienating my audience. British are very hard people to write a book that's directed to, because they expect you to be acerbic, to take the mickey, to have an edge to what you're saying. But at the same time, they want to be loved, I mean, as anyone would.
It's quite a fine line.
And it is a fine line. I mean, I really do love it here. Okay, that's my starting point. I admire an awful lot of things about Britain, probably more than most British do. But I had to be careful not to be too gushing, because people won't buy it if you are. And there are, of course, things that I'm critical about. But what I tried to do was to strike a balance and in the book. And it felt tricky when I was doing it. You know, you don't want to go too far in one direction or the other.
But they offered you a huge advance for this book, didn't they? How much?
I don't talk money publicly.
It's been quoted as 340,000, sight unseen, no synopsis. I mean, you must have thought, you know, your ship had come in.
Well, my ship is, you know, keeps coming in. I there's no denying that I have been just extraordinarily lucky. It is hard to take in. Just the scale of sales and so on. And the fact that it's gone on so long. I mean, it's 2.5 years, I think, now in paperback, and it's still on the bestseller list. And you think, well, who's left to buy the thing? You know, and it was never conceived. I mean, you know, it's a terrible thing, really, because you think, if I'd known it was going to do this, I would have worked a lot harder on it.
But then it wouldn't have been so good.
Well, perhaps. I don't know.
Record number 5.
Is Loudon Wainwright, Your Mother and I. And I chose this because it was a really sad song. It's about divorce. And I chose it for sort of the opposite reasons, because when I heard this song, it made me feel immensely lucky that I've not been in this position before and never expect to be put in this position. So, you know, it just made me feel fortunate.
Your mother and I are living apart. I know that seems stupid, but we weren't very smart. You'll stay with her, I'll visit you. At Christmas, on weekends, in the summertime too. Your mother and I are not getting along. Somehow, somewhere, something went wrong. Everything changes, time takes its toll. Your folks fell in love, love's a very deep hole. Your mother and and I will do all we can do to work this thing out and to take care of you. Families get broken, I know it's a shame. It's nobody's fault though, and you're not to blame.
Loudon Wainwright III with Your Mother and I. You're much better known here, Bill, than you are in the States. How much do you think that's got to do with humour and the fact that, well, we've got more of it?
How modestly you express that. So, there's no question in my mind. It's not as if Americans don't have a sense of humour. I really hate it when people suggest that because, I mean, as we've heard already, Tom Lehrer, brilliantly funny. I mean, you know, a lot of the very funniest people that have ever lived were Americans. But it is a different kind of humor. And the thing that most impressed me about Britain when I first came here was that it covers a much broader spectrum. I mean, like at the lower end, you've got this sort of carry-on Benny Hill, seaside pier type stuff. And at the upper end, you've got the goons and Monty Python and the more zany but tending to be cerebral type stuff that's based on very clever wordplay and that sort of thing.
And irony.
Irony is the strand that runs right through it, and which we are not always very good at in the States. And we seem to be getting worse at it.
Give me an example.
Well, there was an occasion where I was passing through Customs and Immigration in Boston, and one of the immigration officials said to me as I passed, he said, "Any fruit or vegetables?" And I said, "Sure, why not? I'll have 4 pounds of potatoes, please." Grinning when I said it, you know. And he was completely thrown by this. And he said, "Sir, are you carrying any materials of a fruit or vegetative nature?" And he didn't understand that I was teasing him, that I was pulling his leg. And it's that kind of thing that will happen.
Obviously, humour is a large part of your success. Does it become a bit of a millstone? Do you feel now, as you write, you've got to keep putting the jokes in because that's what people expect?
Well, yes. I mean, if I'm doing that kind of a book, yes. But I've tried to move away from that a bit. I think one of the things I've learned in the process of doing this is that some of the earlier books I thought were just too, the humor was too relentless, that it's not sustainable over the length of a book, that you need a little serious relief from time to time, that it just becomes, jokes begin to pall. People don't want to laugh nonstop for 280 pages or whatever.
Well, it becomes a bit superficial, I suppose.
It becomes a bit superficial. Everything you say in humorous vein becomes superficial anyway, that you can make the profoundest point and it will sound glib because you're making a joke about it. And so, you know, I've tried in more recent books to interject more serious interludes into the books because I just think that helps make the humor work better, but also I think it makes it a better book.
Next record.
The next record I've chosen is Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland, which is appropriate to me because one of my biggest projects in the last few years was I tried to hike the Appalachian Trail.
But you failed.
I failed miserably. 2,200 miles is a distance so you cannot conceive. I mean, if I ask you to imagine it, you're going to be thinking in terms of air miles or driving miles, but we're talking foot miles. But what we did do is we learned an awful lot about nature and the greatness of American landscape and what it is to go out into this very difficult and unfamiliar environment.
Thank you.
the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra playing part of the opening of Aaron Copland's ballet Appalachian Spring, conducted by Leonard Slatkin. You wrote somewhere in your books, Bill, that there were three things in life one couldn't do: beat the phone company, make a way to see you until he's ready to see you, and go home again, since when you've gone home again. What's the verdict? Are you less happy there than you were here? Personally, I mean, you...
Yeah, it was much, much harder than I had expected it to be. We got there, and I can remember very, very clearly waking up in this house in New Hampshire that we had just bought, and waking up looking out the window the first morning that we had slept there, and thinking, oh, God, what have we done? Because for me, it just felt like a terrible mistake. It was really... It was a catastrophe. It was not what I wanted to do. And what it felt like to me was exactly like moving back in with your parents in middle age. You know, they may be perfectly delightful people. Love them to pieces. You just don't want to live with them anymore. And I felt like that about an entire country.
But what do you miss about us? Tell us how much you miss us.
Oh, all kinds of things. I miss friends, of course, because I spent, you know, virtually the whole of my adult life here until 3 years ago. So all of my grown-up, long-term friends are here. That was hard. I miss the pub. I miss television. I miss, you know, the fact that TV can actually be good sometimes. That it, you know, that there is this sense that television actually has an obligation to give you something more than just very lightweight entertainment. It's such a strange sensation. I mean, I come back and I have actually found myself in the position where I turn on the TV and found myself excited to see John Ketley doing the weather, you know. And it was really, really hard. I've now reached the point where I'm very much more comfortable with it and really like the fact that I feel happy and comfortable and at home in both places, and that I've bounced back and forth enough now for the last 3.5 years that it makes me feel quite suave and cosmopolitan, that I, you know, get off a plane in Boston and I immediately know what's going on and I'm comfortable and, you know, nothing there.
But being suave and cosmopolitan is not what you aspire to at all.
Well, it's not actually what I achieve either, but it's what I, but it's what I like to fancy myself sometimes.
You aspire to sort of, well, 1950s life, really, don't you? You want it, as you were saying earlier, to be really quite small time again, where children are wide-eyed with amazement and make things out of brown paper and cardboard
boxes. I do miss that. I think, you know, there is a certain appealing side to life, a certain satisfaction in simplicity. I think you do have that rather better here. It's going. It's going everywhere. And
it's going fast.
It's going very fast. I mean, Britain isn't remotely the same place it was when I came over here. And in a lot of ways, this is a much, much more comfortable, easy country than it used to be. I mean, you know, you can get things on Sunday now. That heartbreak that used to come when you'd go to do your grocery shopping at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and discover that it was early closing in this particular community. You know, that kind of thing is all gone. It's just fading fast. But there was something that was nice about it. Inconvenient as it was, frustrating as it was at times, it did impose a certain simplicity on life that, you know, your ambitions were smaller.
Record number 7.
Is Archie Roach, who's an Australian, and I know almost nothing about him, but that's part of what I like. Australia's the next book I'm going to do. I'm about to go out to Australia to start doing the research. And one of the things that fascinates me about Australia is that when I go there, there are all these things that are happening there that I've never heard about. And Archie Roach, musically, seemed like that to me. I saw him on television there, and they played a couple of snippets from his songs, and I thought his music sounded very appealing and it ought to appeal to a wider audience.
I'm dancing with my spirit. I am dancing with my spirit. Now we are free. Come dance with me, and we might see, yeah, life's mystery. Now we'll hold you, I will love.
Artie Roach, Dancing with My Spirit. Well, forget about comfort and company now, Bill, because we come to the painful bit. This is where you get dumped on a desert island with practically nothing. Does it hold any appeal to you at all?
No. No. In the sense that I spend an awful lot of time in, I have a great deal of experience with solitude. And I miss my wife and kids. I'm away from them a lot.
But friends and family apart, what do you think you'd miss most about civilized life?
That's a really good question. I would feel terribly frustrated that I couldn't move around. I do have a measure of wanderlust. I want to keep traveling and to have that entirely taken away, however comfortable your desert island might be, however much room there might be to roam on it, I would still, I would feel cheated that I couldn't go to Japan or Australia or some other different place and have that wonderful sense of constant variety in my life.
Last record
is Anne-Sophie Mutter playing the adagio from Brooks' Violin Concerto No. 1 in G minor, which I chose because somebody who really knows music suggested it, and I thought it'd make me sound a little classier.
Sophie Mutter playing the adagio from Bruch's Violin Concerto No. 1 in G minor with the Berlin Philharmonic conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Well, that'll cheer you up on your desert island, won't it? Which of the eight, then, if you could only take one?
I think it would have to be Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Your book, you've got the Bible and you've got the complete works of Shakespeare sitting waiting for you.
Well, if it doesn't seem too vain, I think what I'd like to do would be to take The Lost Continent with me, my own book, because it's, one of the things you do when you write is, when you read through these books again, you think, God, I wish I'd done that differently. I wish I had a chance to do that all over again.
So you're going to sit and sub yourself.
I'm going to sub myself. I think, the idea of having that kind of leisure and time, and it, even if no one ever read it, if it perished with me out there, I would still, it would be so satisfying to be able to take something that you've done and have had to live with for a number of years and be able to do it all over again and try to get it right this time.
And your luxury?
My luxury, I think, would probably be a basketball and hoop. I'd also need a little hard standing. Can I ask for that as well?
Because, standing is yours.
Because you can't dribble on sand, a basketball. But it is, I think, probably the only ball game that you can do on your own, and it's immensely soothing and satisfying just to shoot baskets, just to throw a ball up and try and get it through a circular hole.
Bill Bryson, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your desert island.
Thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Desert Island Discs, Bill Bryson, was presented by Sue Lawley, produced by Angie Naring, and first broadcast on BBC Radio 4 on the 31st of January 1999.